Hi everyone, thanks for coming. I'm Carlos. I'll be talking about some of the work we've done in collaboration with UC Dublin, Brian Hamish and John, and my advisor Claudio Silva in Utah. So back in 2006, Hamish, Brian, and Barry were concerned about trying to figure out some of the mathematical underpinnings about what happens to histograms when you find them continuously. And we'll show here that they almost got it right. There's a small change in the formula. And so there is, we are presenting a new formula for the histogram that points to some shortcomings of histograms which are independent of convergence issues. So with that framework, we're going to study what happens if you pick one isosurface at random in the volume, how big should that be? And then we're going to show that noise seems to have a large influence on that figure. So just to get started with some intuition, imagine you have a histogram that looks for an image that looks something like on the bottom left. So it's just a one-to-one image. And let's say that you want to start with large bins, and so each horizontal part of the bin, the blue and the red sizes, they contribute to some amount of domain, and these get accumulated on the histogram, which is shown as the distribution there. So you can see that if there isn't a big change on the y-axis, all the data gets compressed into a small size of the histogram. So this gets more accentuated as you reduce the size of your bins. And in the limit, what will happen is that what you get is something that looks like this. And in essence, what this is telling us is that on this really simple example, if you have a small derivative on the function, you will get a large histogram value. And if you have a large derivative, you have a small histogram value. So there's something going on with the differential properties of the function there. So let's look a little bit more closely in what happens in the 2D case. So now what we're going to do is that we're going to squish two planes over this function, and the amount of the domain that we are catching is shown in black in the bottom. So you can see that as we reduce the size, as we're moving towards the limit, this starts to look sort of like what you'd get if you were extracting a contour. But as you're going closer and closer to the limit, you should see that they don't go to the limit in the same speed. So really what's going on is that this will start to look like the area of the contour, but notice that there's different widths in there. And if you look on the top, what's going on is that on one of the sides of the contour, the gradient magnitude is much bigger on the other one. So what we're going to show here is that the gradient magnitude fundamentally affects the histograms that you're computing, and we need to be careful about those things. So what we're going to be doing here is examining some of the consequences of that. So how do we actually compute this continuous histogram? Well, we start with a simplest way that we can compute the cumulative histogram, which is just integrating the amount of points that are more than a certain isovalue. So this is just a really simple integral of 1 over all the points that share an isosurface value. And if we want to actually get the histogram, we just take the derivative of that with respect to h. But there is no simple way to take the derivative of that, so we need some mathematical tool to do that. And this is where the coarea formula comes into play. So let's say we start with a region in space that has some function defined over it that defines the height. And let's say that we have some integral that's defined over the level sets of this function. So the domain is just where the inverse of the function intersects the region that we're interested in. So if we are willing to put another integral around that that goes over a certain range of your function, so now you're covering a big, thick slab of the region, what turns out is that what the coarea formula tells us is that this is equivalent to taking an integral over the entire domain, for which we have that correction term that you see there. And the reason that correction term comes into play is that if you look at through the side of this, and now the dark line represents the function that we have the height for, and the level sets are now crossing them at a uniform pace because our y scale is uniform. So notice that there's a density change going from one to the other, and this is exactly what the gradient magnitude captures. So to reiterate what the coarea formula does is, given an integral over the codomain and an integral over the range over that, that just turns into an integral over the domain with that gradient. So now that we have this, we're almost there with our formulation. We just need to set a special value for the q of x that's sitting there, and we just clearly set it to the inverse gradient magnitude. And then we get the definition for our cumulative histogram, for which when we take the derivative, that's the formula that we end up with. So this almost looks like what Brian Hamish and Barry did in 2006, except to have that inverse gradient magnitude term. And so you can see that that has a really simple intuitive explanation, which is the ratio between the value that they got in the last 2 years ago and the ratio that we get here, for which is actually the correct formula for the histogram, is essentially the inverse gradient magnitude. And the reason that their formulation was slightly incorrect, if you go back and read to the paper, is that it's actually tricky to use direct deltas in the codomain. You technically can't do that, so you get the gradient magnitude term wrong. So this small correction actually lets us explain some of the differences that we got. So this is just now looking at some pictures of the histograms, and the things that I want you to pay attention to is that the dashed line is the previous results, and the solid lines are the different ways that we can actually compute our results. And the solid gray area is just the histogram computed with, I believe, 100 bins. So I hope everyone can look at this side of the... So the interesting thing here to see is, well, while the previous formula sometimes undershoots and sometimes overshoots the formula, can we explain this? And remember that the ratio between these two is just the average inverse gradient magnitude. And we're using the square distance data set, so the gradient will essentially start increasing linearly as we go through the range. So we should expect it to start essentially undershooting and then overshooting, because this value will go from 0 to 1 and then over it, and that's exactly what happens. And we can go over the other results and see that we essentially get the same order of convergence that was the important point, the second important point about 2006 paper, which is this converges a lot faster than histograms. So we also converge a lot faster, but we actually converge to what the histogram tells us with these differences in the cusps. And we can go over the other ones and see that that's indeed the case. And you can see that as you increase noise, so this is just volume rendering with an MRI data set. And you can see that this is sort of noise. You can actually see some of the noise there. And you can see the histogram doesn't really tell you the whole story, while our function actually converges to what you'd expect it to. And some more of the discrepancies that actually go away when you put the gradient weighting term there. So, well, why should we care about this? One of the reasons that we believe this result is interesting is that it turns out that we've been sort of talking about this for a long time now, but no one realized that the gradient magnitude was sort of the unifying theme along all of this. So Krauss had a really nice paper 3 years ago called Scale Invariant Volume Rendering, and in one of the lines of the paper he says you have to be careful when you go from domain to codomain to scale by the gradient magnitude, otherwise your isosurfaces get different opacities. And this turns out to be exactly what you want to do in our case, and the Coyer formula gives this nice formalism to show that that's actually indeed the case. The Coyer formula was actually introduced in graphics, as far as we can tell, by Mullen et al. And Seagraph 2 years ago, and this is a really nice paper. I encourage you to read that. And that's actually where we got the particular formula we are using, while the Coyer formula is general for arbitrary dimension and codimension. And indeed, Sven Bachtele and Dan Weisskopf presented an incredible paper in the InfoVis section, which takes the same idea, and what they're doing is to actually get a much better scatter plot. Instead of doing the scatter plot discretely, they do it continuously, and turns out that their formalism is exactly equivalent to the Coyer formula. And as we'll see, this has connections to the contour spectrum, to the average complexity of isosurfaces, and this whole thing started essentially by Carr and his students looking at these properties. So the first nice result of this whole framework is that we can see that the contour spectra are really essentially just a particular weighted way of doing histograms. So using our formula, we can see that if you start with just the histogram, which is integrating this constant thing over the volume, what you get is the inverse gradient magnitude. But if you remember from the contour spectrum, what they were doing is integrating the area over it, so we can just use the Coyer formula on the other hand and get that this should be the integral of the gradient magnitude over the whole volume, and the same thing goes for the area weighted by the gradient. So this directly lets us compute contour spectra from the volumes, just like we do it with histograms, without actually worrying about what grids we're doing this on, which was the case for the contour spectra, because you only have closed formulas for tetrahedral meshes. So the takeaway is, if you don't put any weighting, you get the histogram. If you put gradient weighting, you actually get the contour spectrum. So now, with this, we're going to switch over to the question that we were originally interested in answering, which was, imagine you pick an isosurface at random from a volume. And so the question we're interested in is, how big will it be? Will it be tiny? Will it cover most of the volume? How big will it be? This is important because it directly relates to output-sensitive acceleration structures. If you look at the results of how fast it takes to generate an isosurface, there are methods that are competitive to within a certain size of the input. However, they all have the plus k term, which means how big is it the output. So if you have a good control over what the output is, we can get a better idea for the running time that we can expect there to be. And this question dates back to the Extrema Graphs paper from Dr. Ito and Koyamada back in 1994. In this case, what we're going to be using, because it's mathematically convenient, is that we're going to use the area as a measure of the complexity. And since most of the methods assume some sort of uniform grid, the ones that use the output-sensitive acceleration structures, this gives us a good idea for how the triangle count will be. So there's a very direct correlation between them. So let's compute the average. You know, we start with the smallest scalar. We range uniformly to the biggest scalar, computing the areas, and we divide by the range that we got, right? That should be the average. Well, what happens is that if you compute that for this particular volume, which the volume on the left, which is our original function, you get one value, and on the right, we have a volume that shares exactly the same set of isosurfaces. So we just deformed it with a monotonic function that's not linear, and for every for every isosurface on the left side, there exists an isosurface with the exact same set of points on the other side. The scalar value just happens to be different. And if you compute this, you get a different result. You get 1.2 on the left and 1.6 on the right. What gives? Well, what gives is that we just use our trusty Coiré formula again, and we get the integral of the gradient magnitude, and then it's pretty easy to check that that will actually show you that if you compute the average like I described, it's not consistent even though the two volumes share the exact same set of isosurfaces. And this is sort of unexpected, so we would expect that if we're talking about isosurfaces, these should be consistent. So how do we fix this? Well, our solution is to define the area average over a particular scalar field as the expectation of the area, so A sub F here is just the expectation of the area, multiplied by the probability given by the actual histogram. And it turns out that we can prove that this is invariant under any monotonic G that you actually use to change it, and I'm not going to go over that, but it's easy to prove if you remember calculus, and it's actually pretty simple. So the real question is, how do we compute this? You know, how do we make sure that this is the value that we want to do? And there are two ways of doing that. So the first one uses the idea where we can just take this original volume, we can equalize the histogram, and we can compute, or we can use Monte Carlo integration. So remembering that this is the histogram and these are the isosurface areas, let me just switch to the new slide. And this on the left is the volume that we had on the left before, and this on the right is the volume that we had on the right before. Even though they have the same set of isosurfaces, if you linearly scan through the set of them, what you get is this bunching up in the middle, which you would expect, as you remember, they were all displaced. So it's to be expected that you get different values. So the way to make these invariant is if you happen to have code to equalize the histograms, you just run a histogram equalization on your volume, and then you recompute the linear average. And the reason this works is that there is a somewhat unknown but pretty trivial property of a equalized histogram, which is in this, equal scalar ranges span equal areas of your volume. And that's sort of a way of defining histogram equalization. If you remember that you're transforming it by the cumulative histogram, and the histogram is just a set of points, this should be pretty obvious. So what you get is just these uniform stepping over the isosurfaces, which is exactly what you want. But histogram equalization has some issues, which is not exactly, it doesn't really get you a flat histogram, so you'd like to do something else. And for that, we suggest that you can do instead Monte Carlo integration, which is a trick where if you have easy access to samples that are proportional to your probability distribution, you just pick them, you just compute the area or compute whatever random variable you're interested in, and then you let the sample mean converge. And then the question is, well, how do we pick our samples proportional to the distribution? We just remember they are the histogram. So it's really trivial to pick those. You just go through the volume, you pick one point at random in your volume, you look at the iso value, you extract that isosurface, you pick a next one, and you keep doing this until it converges. And that will be your A of F that's invariant trivially to the changes, because you're not changing anything in domain, you're changing only in the range. So there's a few differences between this that I'd like to make clear so that we understand, is that This invariant average, it actually weighs the eigenvalues proportionally to the voxel values in the volume. So it's the same thing that happens when you equalize a histogram where you're not interested in most of the voxels. Those will take up most of the interesting part of your range. So this might not be what you're expecting, and it's actually pretty fundamentally different than scanning the range. So you just have to remember that it's equivalent to scanning the range of the equalized histogram volume. And even though this is a somewhat unnatural model, it's actually the only way that you can make it be invariant to these range transformations. So with this framework in mind, we decided to actually measure the complexity of the volumes that we have. So we use the same data set that Carr and co-authors used 2 years ago. It's about 80 volumes ranging from 32 cubed to 512 cubed. They're all quantized to 8 bits or 16 bits, but I'll talk a little bit more about quantization later. And we compute our means for the area using the Monte Carlo-based algorithm. And now what we're interested in doing is let's see what the order of growth is, which is exactly the same thing that they did 2 years ago. And what we see is that this is the result that they got, which was already much larger than people expected, and it's really something that we should stop and think about, which is this is almost linear. Okay, so that means that if for a bunch of the volumes that we are looking online, the relation between the expected size and the input size is pretty large. And that means, for example, if you're using span space, it hits square root of n plus k, but this is much larger than k, so on average, you're spending more time actually dumping triangles than searching your span space structure. But what we find is when we use our average that's actually invariant to these changes, we see a much larger slope than they saw. We actually see it pretty close to being 0.96, and that's even more intriguing. However, there are a few caveats that I should point out. If you look at the slopes of any of the particular fits when you split them down into different types of data, medical, simulated, and measured, they're all smaller than the best fit, which probably means that a power law is too simple of a model to be here, but that's the result that we got. And to see exactly how these should come about and why the n two-thirds actually shows up, I point you all to the paper. Thanks. So the next thing that we were concerned is, well, could more noise be an influence over this? So now what we are doing is we took two synthetic models for which we knew how to evaluate them analytically, and we created a set of volumes of different sizes and different noise levels. Then we took the same measurement that we did with the two-thirds fit, and we pointed them for a set of values of different sizes. And so each of these is one data point here. So each data point in the volume is one power law fit, and then we let this graph vary with the standard deviation of noise. And you can see that if there is no noise, you start at values pretty close to what you'd predict theoretically, which is close to the two-thirds. And as you increase the noise, you go closer to a degenerate case of around 1.0. So really noise, as we modeled it here, which is independently distributed Gaussian noise, seems to make a huge difference on these isosurface sizes, which is not too unexpected, but it seems to explain pretty well what's going on. And the reason the Marshner-Lob curve starts at 0.9 is because at a few of the resolutions, it actually cannot resolve because Marshner-Lob uses these really high-frequency functions. So as you're increasing the sampling size, you're actually resolving more triangles due to the aliasing and due to the noise as well. So you start already pretty close to 0.9. So the last thing we wanted to check is quantization going to kill us? And it actually doesn't. So this is just increasing the number of bits that we have in our disposal, and you can see that it doesn't really make that much of a difference. So, to wrap up, the main story here is that histogram emphasizes small gradient magnitudes. And if you go back and think of things like CT scans, if we're picking good isovalues, we're typically interested in the large gradient values. So this might help explain why sometimes the histogram looks one way while expected to look pretty different. So there's a fundamental reason why they are a bad indicator of these good isovalues. In the cases where you're looking for a large gradient, do not use the histogram. It will not give you a good result. And one of the nice things is that this formulation allows us to define these integrals over all isosurfaces that are invariant under these transformations. So if you're not interested in doing air, you're interested in doing something else, you can just apply the same thing and you have the same results. But remember, this is a slightly different weighting model, and you should be careful about that. So the one thing that we want to investigate in the future is how do we get spatial correlation right? As I told you, we use IID Gaussian noise at every point in the volume, well, if that was taken to the limit, we would get a non-differentiable surface everywhere. And so you need spatial correlation, and so we're looking into things like Gaussian random fields and things like that and see what the results are. Then I'd like to thank you and thank my funding agencies, and all the data and source code for this are available on my website, so please go there and tell me it doesn't work. I'd like to thank Patrick Mullen, Martin Krauss, and Valerio for letting me use their figures in our slides. And with that, I'm open for questions. Thank you very much.
Please go up to the mics. I encourage you to ask questions. Go ahead.
Hi. I may have just missed this. What is the interpolation function that's implied?
We are using linear interpolation, but we tried a few different... So the nice thing about linear interpolation is that we don't have to worry about it, and that's exactly what we get with marching cubes, essentially. But you could, instead of doing that, we could just take the cubic interpolation and sample it super densely and try it again. It doesn't seem to make much of a difference.
I'm just thinking about interpolation kernels that ring, like MR data properly interpolated uses a sync function, and that would seem to make things a little complicated.
That's a good question. We should be more careful about how to reconstruct from the data modality all the way through, because that's the only way to actually evaluate the noise properly and all that. I'd be happy to talk to you about how to do that in a careful way.
Cool, and thanks for making the source available.
Okay, anyone else? Please go up to the mic. No? Well, I've got one in that case. So again, on the theme of generalization, have you thought about going to a histogram where the domain of the histogram is 2D? In other words, there are bins in X and Y, for example.
We thought about it. We were focusing on histograms, but thankfully, Bachtheller and Weisskopf solved that problem for us. They have a really nice continuous scatter plots paper, which is essentially the 2D. And their generalization is essentially, you take the Courier formula and you see what it looks like in higher D. So the same formulation works, and they actually did the generalization for us. So,
well, I guess we should all look at that paper. If there are no other questions, let's thank Carlos again.